It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the author of a new book says the key to being less lonely and feeling more connected is to talk to strangers. We'll find out why and how to do it. First, President Biden is defending his administration's handling of the crisis in Afghanistan. In an interview with ABC News yesterday, Biden says the Taliban's takeover of Kabul and other areas were bound to happen with U.S. troops leaving the country.
I don't think it could have been handled in a way that we're going to go back in hindsight and look. But the idea that somehow there's a way to have gotten out without chaos ensuing, I don't know how that happens. I don't know how that happened.
So for you, that was always priced into the decision?
Yes.
His comments come days after images surfaced of Afghans surrounding U.S. military aircraft, some even clinging to a plane as it was taking off, trying to flee the country. Our next guest served in Afghanistan and says, despite the chaos, withdrawing American troops is still the right thing to do. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How are you feeling about what's going on in Afghanistan? If you or someone you know served in the war there, what's going through your mind as you see American troops leaving, the Taliban taking back the country? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sam Rogers is Coalition's Director of Concerned Veterans for America, Wisconsin, and an Army veteran of the war in Afghanistan. His piece reaffirming his support for leaving Afghanistan was published this morning in USA Today. Sam, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob. I wish you could be under better circumstances.
Yeah, we've talked to you about the U.S. presence in Afghanistan before. You were hoping to see U.S. troops come home. As we see it happening now and what's going on in Afghanistan, what's your general reaction from your experiences there and since?
Seeing Taliban slide through all of these cities and villages and airports and places we've cleared and secured at great personal cost over the years it feels crushing, you know, and I've heard a lot of that from our veteran community, particularly our Afghan war vets. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's still the right decision. We have to get our military out of that country and out of that conflict. But it's hard, you know, it's not the right time to endlessly analyze the execution, the tactical and strategic decisions that are being made. We have all the time in the world for that after we get our Americans and our allies and our people out of there.
And you, there's a lot of finger pointing going on right now about a blame for how we got here. And as you were just starting to say, you don't see this as the time for that. What do you want to see the focus on right now?
You know, I want to see the focus on supporting, bringing folks home. I want to see veteran communities and leaders checking in on our Afghanistan war veterans. A lot of these folks, you know, and it's not an individual blame situation, right? There's four presidential administrations, hundreds of commanding generals, bureaucrats and different agencies have all played a big part in why this conflict has gone on for 20 years. And the problem is right now, with no one taking responsibility for at the top for being a part of this, a lot of Afghan war veterans are looking internally and they're feeling a lot of extra guilt. And I think that's the wrong answer. We need more leaders stepping up on the front end of this.
Can you talk for a moment directly to any of your fellow Afghan war veterans who might be listening and going through those feelings right now? What would you say to them?
Every single man and woman who put on that uniform and went to that country added value. Your time there meant something. We killed bad guys. We protected each other. Your service, your valor, your heroism, your patriotism, none of that is in question. That's a separate thing from this strategic, political, foreign policy failure that perpetuated this campaign. You guys are all amazing. I love you. Reach out to me at CVA Wisconsin on my Twitter if you need to talk about this, and I'm here for you guys.
Remind us, Sam, of why you had already been making the case that the U.S. should get out of Afghanistan. You supported the Trump administration's call to do that. You were with the Biden administration as they continued the call to withdraw U.S. troops from Afghanistan. why do you see it as time, past time even to do that?
Well, you know, this, the Afghanistan campaign has not made us safer. It's continued to create ripple effects throughout our society and its costs and the mental health incomes, outcomes, you know, a million life-changing disabilities. And this is, it's important to remember, this is the first step on a path to reform to keep this from happening again in the future. This is not the finish line. And I want people to keep that in mind, that that when this is over, we will have to continue to move forward to demand changes and accountability from our elected officials to make sure that we end up in this exact same predicament again, or that our children don't.
Talking to Sam Rogers, Coalition's Director of Concerned Veterans for America, Wisconsin, an Army veteran of the war in Afghanistan. He wrote a piece that appears today in USA Today, looking at the American troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions. If you served in Afghanistan, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sam, we're seeing definitely some people saying, well, hang on, look at what's happened so quickly in Afghanistan. If we had kept this comparatively limited U.S. troop presence compared to, you know, where we were years back, we could have sustain this indefinitely. In a way, we could have prevented this mass chaos from happening with this small presence. Why not do that?
Right. Well, I mean, you got to remember that the Doha Agreement was signed 18 months ago, and this period of peace that people are describing, this low cost, no service members killed, was part of an agreement between our government, the Taliban, and the Afghan government. And that's the only reason that there hasn't been further bloodshed, is because this was part of this transition.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jerry is with us in Waukesha. Jerry, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Jerry?
Well, I want to make several comments. It's a god-awful shame. It's an embarrassment for the United States of America. And it's a completely unconscionable decision of how President Biden allowed this to happen and orchestrated it in the way that he did. You don't remove troops and then leave the people behind and the billions of dollars in military equipment. You bring out the people first, you bring out the equipment second, and the troops are the last to leave on a few C-60s or C-70 transports.
Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. Sam, is there some justification in saying this, the order, the logistics of this withdrawal was mishandled?
I think any logistician or any service member of any generation their brain is probably screaming watching this unfold the way it has been. With so many thousands of Americans, American civilians and employees still trapped in Afghanistan, I just want to focus on making sure those people get home safe, and we can dig into this stuff afterwards and hold folks accountable.
Thanks for the call, Jerry, at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the latest in Afghanistan, including the capital city of Kabul, with Sam Rogers. He's Coalition's Director of Concerned Veterans for America, Wisconsin, veteran of the Afghanistan war. He says, in spite of the difficulties of the last week, he says it was the right decision to pull troops out, and he wants to avoid getting caught up in long-term deployments like this in the future. We'll talk about that coming up, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on what is happening in Afghanistan. If you served there at some point in the last 20 years now, what do you think of withdrawing troops from Afghanistan at this point? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about Afghanistan and the Taliban's takeover of parts of the country, as well as Kabul, the capital. Sam Rogers stays with us, Coalition's Director of Concerned Veterans of America, Wisconsin, an Army veteran of the war in Afghanistan. He wrote about the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in today's USA Today. He supports the decision ultimately to remove all U.S. troops from that country. you can join in at 800-642-1234. Let us know how you feel about the troop withdrawal, how it's gone in the last week, whether you think that it's time or past time for American troops to come home, or you wanted them to stay longer, and do you have thoughts on maybe avoiding long-term deployments like this in the future? You can join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Sam, a few minutes ago, you mentioned this is not the end of the story here. You're concerned about how we prevent long-term sort of mission creep stories like this, dragging the U.S. into long deployments in combat situations like this. What kind of things, what kind of lessons are you hoping we learn?
Absolutely. You know, there's a large bipartisan effort right now to remedy a lot of this broken process in the authorizations for use of military force. And that's essentially a limited declaration of force by the Congress. It's below an act, you know, opening and authorizing a war. But they're supposed to be extremely specific and limited in scope to define what it is we're doing. Now, after the September 11th terrorist attacks in New York that killed, you know, almost 3,000 American civilians and first responders, the Congress authorized the United States military to go to Afghanistan to punish the Taliban government for harboring al-Qaeda, to kill al-Qaeda terrorists and operatives and supporters. And these goals, these objectives were accomplished by men and women on the ground in very short time, you know, months even. And even if you stretch that that idea to the killing of Osama bin Laden in 2010, that was still half, you know, at the halfway point of this conflict so far. And long term, subsequent administrations have reimagined this tiny one-third of a page 2001 authorization for use of military force to include over 19 different countries, many of which we still have military forces in.
Why do you think we got drawn in so long term in Afghanistan with the Republican and Democratic administrations at the helm?
Honestly, the Congress has essentially abdicated their war powers to the executive branch, which means that they can't really effectively be held accountable for what it is the military's doing. So, you know, the AUMF to invade Iraq, you know, the vast majority of elected officials who voted to invade Iraq were left the Congress and the Senate were voted out over the subsequent over subsequent elections. You know, less than 15% of the original signees of the 2001 AUMF are still in the Congress. And that means that they don't face scrutiny or potential accountability for this extended campaign. It's a car with no one behind the wheel.
Talking to Sam Rogers, Coalition's Director of Concerned Veterans for America, Wisconsin, an Army veteran of the war in Afghanistan, looking at the U.S. withdrawal, troop withdrawal from that country, the Taliban takeover, and whether we've learned any lessons in the last 20 years about when and how we use American troops in foreign countries. You can join in with your thoughts on that topic at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Sam, Afghanistan is all over the news in this last couple of weeks now. In a lot of ways, it's been under the radar somehow in the last bunch of years. Do you think there's been a disconnect between the American public and the reality that we've still been in Afghanistan all this time?
Absolutely. I think the New York Times did a study and found that 79% of service members now come from military families, which means the burden of these campaigns is shrinking and shrinking. You know, Rob, I went there three times. And to be frank, I feel like I didn't do enough sometimes, because I know soldiers who have gone 10 times, who have adult sons who have gone two and three times. And this is, if you don't know someone, if you don't live next door to someone, if you're not in a military town, you might not see any exposure to this outside of disasters like, you know, the ones that we're seeing unfold now, that really capture the media.
How do we bridge that gap? How do we keep that awareness of the reality of U.S. troop deployments when, as you say, so many people don't have that direct connection?
Right. I think it's folks like yourself and public radio who try to do a good job to bring in outside perspectives and unique experiences to share these with our communities. There's a great podcast in Wisconsin called the Frag Out Podcast. It's run by a veteran up in Appleton, and all they do is share military stories and service stories from around our great state, and really try to connect our communities to the military experience and the military family experience.
Sam, there's some surveys suggesting that a slightly growing number of Americans is willing to send troops back to Afghanistan. There's worry now that, okay, if it's a Taliban rule again, they'll once again provide a safe space potentially for international terrorists, and we'll be back where we started and looking at maybe new interventions. Does that worry you?
You know, I think we saw that 20 years worth of nation building and military training and providing the best equipment money could buy to these militaries didn't even survive a week outside of our direct control and support. And at the end of the day, while the 9/11 terrorist attacks were planned and plotted in Afghanistan, 9/11 itself, right, was a domestic security failure. And we've done a lot domestically. We spent over $1 trillion on the Department of Homeland Security, the Director of National Intelligence, to get our intelligence agencies, domestic security agencies, to work together to collaborate, and as well as we've got the Patriot Act, where we gave away a decent chunk of our Fourth Amendment rights to secure our homeland domestically to prevent another 9/11 type attack. Afghanistan was intended to be a punitive campaign. It was a punishment for the Taliban government harboring Al-Qaeda and supporting them in the goal of murdering our innocent people.
What would you say to policymakers now as they think about how they authorize the use of military force, as members of Congress maybe try to rein in the executive branch? What would you tell them?
My recommendation, and the one that we've made publicly, and we've been working with bipartisan legislators all around the country on, is we want to see an expiration date in these future AUMFs. We want to see potentially a reauthorization every 2 years, so that the entire Congress, each Congress, invests personally in our foreign policy, our country's vision abroad, for and how we want to use our military around the world. And we think that will see less expeditions that are either unserious or that might not directly contribute to our national defense.
Let's go back to our callers now. Margie is with us in Milwaukee. Margie, hi.
Hi. I totally agree with the pullout. Unconscionable that we've been there this long. My two concerns are the fact that the interpreters were not dealt with fairly. I watched the Rachel Maddow program last night, and one of the guys was showing what he had to do to get his interpreter out, and he's been with us for 6 years. That's ridiculous. And the other thing is, how do you pull out and then let the Army be on its own? Why wasn't the Army, the Afghan Army, given sections of the country to prove their worth, and then we'd slowly pull out because they kept taking more and more of the country under their own control? I think it's been a sham overall for all administrations.
Margie, thanks for the call. Sam, Margie referring to Afghan interpreters who had worked with the U.S. military, and that's one of the big questions now. How do we get them to safety? What are your thoughts on that?
Right. That's another huge priority in the veteran community. There's a lot of really excellent organizations working on that, like No One Left Behind. I know Wisconsin is slated to receive some folks from Afghanistan. I can tell you personally, Margie, my life was saved by a translator on my first deployment. And it's something that the veteran community is very passionate about. And I'll also say that what you described, Margie, a transitional handover of authority, has essentially been going on for the last 10 years. And, you know, this was the, you know, it's crawl, walk, run, and this was the run phase. And it was ineffective. And part of that, you know, part of that is there's some ownership in the Afghan leadership, who, you know, the president departed the country and told his military folks to lay down arms. And, you know, these are things that these are all problems that have been consistently identified by the men and women in uniform out in Afghanistan, trying to train local troops, local militia, local government, and just seeing hopeless corruption and a lack of investment in that government by the people of Afghanistan because it was so hopelessly corrupt.
Margie, thanks for that call. In our last minute, Sam, now that the war is about to end, at least the U.S. involvement there, what do Afghanistan veterans need most right now?
I think they need compassion, you know, and empathy, and reach out to them, see how they're doing, help them talk through their issues and have conversations, connect them with other veterans. I can't tell you how many Vietnam veterans I've had reach out to me, and, you know, guys who have just said, I know what this feels like and I'm here for you. And these are the same folks who are the ones who fought for all the resources that us Global War on Terror veterans have. And I can't tell you from the bottom of my heart how much I appreciate our Vietnam brothers and sisters who have been there for us.
Sam, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks so much, Rob. I appreciate you.
And you too. That's Sam Rogers, Coalition's Director of Concerned Veterans for America, Wisconsin, and Army Veteran of the War in Afghanistan. We talked to him today about the U.S. withdrawal from the country, the Taliban's takeover of Kabul, and priorities for Afghanistan war vets. Coming up after the news, when's the last time you talked to a stranger? Our guest says we can get a lot out of it if we can overcome our fear, our anxiety about talking to people we don't know. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, some families turned to virtual schools or homeschooling during the pandemic. Are those changes here to stay? Find out more and share your experiences tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, have you ever wanted to feel happier, less lonely, more connected to the place you live? Our next guest says the answer may be talking to strangers. He says that in a world of polarization and rising rates of loneliness, connections with strangers could be the missing piece. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you start up conversations with strangers? If so, in what settings? What do you talk about? If not, has a stranger talked to you? How do you feel when that happens? Do you have questions about how to break the ice with somebody you don't know anything about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joe Cohane is a writer and editor working with publications including Medium, Esquire, and Wired. His new book is called The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thanks so much for having me on.
Were you a natural talker to strangers before you set out on what led to this book, or were you more like me and a little more shy about it?
I was definitely raised by people who talk to strangers all the time. I grew up in Boston, so I got to see my parents kind of chatting up everyone everywhere they went. And even more important, I saw them make friends like throughout their entire lives. So I was definitely raised in the sort of environment where that was normal. And Boston tends to be like a pretty garrulous place. But for me, I kind of fell in the middle. I've been working as a journalist for 20 years, which means I talk to strangers all the time. But I found at a certain point a few years ago that I had kind of stopped doing it out in the wild in coffee shops and bars, things like that. And I kind of wondered why that had happened. And that was the beginning of the book.
We are often suspicious of strangers. You even referenced that the subtitle to your book. We've had stranger danger and worries about, you know, what does that person want? Are they going to try to sell me something? Whatever. Why are we so reluctant to talk to people?
Yeah, it's a complicated answer. I mean, certainly, first of all, for people of my generation, you were raised with the stranger danger propaganda, which literally meant police officers like coming into your school and telling you that everyone you don't know in the world poses a mortal threat to you, which, as it turns out, is not the healthiest thing to tell a child. But there are other things, too. You know, I think humans are naturally wary of strangers. That's always been the case. That's unavoidable. But then there are all sorts of impediments that keep people from having these interactions. And those can be varied. They can range from fear of rejection to concerns that they won't have anything to talk about to concerns that this just simply isn't a thing that's done.
You reference, there's a long history and prehistory of a value of talking to strangers. You look at ancient Greece and the values found in the Odyssey, where if you're mean to strangers, you'll end up dying. Christianity, Islam, the list goes on and on. There's so many injunctions in the world saying, you got to take care of strangers. Why has that been such a fundamental part of humanity?
It's just, you know, we kind of have a dial. Some philosophers have argued that we have a moral dial. And under certain circumstances, we can be really xenophobic and really dehumanizing and really violent. And in other circumstances, we can be extraordinarily cooperative and communicative and open to interacting with people we don't know. So under the right circumstances, we're amazingly good at living with strangers and talking to strangers and cooperating with strangers, especially in the context of the natural world. You know, I'm a journalist, so I tend to be skeptical, kind of verging on cynical, obviously. But I came away from this project being much more optimistic because you realize, you know, the more pessimistic knock against humanity is that we are by nature xenophobic, right? That we are afraid of strangers, that we are hostile. But civilization doesn't happen if that's our default mode. You know, if that's our default, we're fighting in small bands forever, for a million years. Instead, because we have this capacity that you don't see in other primates, you don't see anywhere else, to live with strangers and work with strangers and cooperate with strangers, that allowed cities to happen, that allowed communities, bigger communities to happen, nations to happen, all these things. It's a phenomenally powerful phenomenally powerful gift that we have to do this, but we don't give ourselves enough credit for it.
In the book, you go from that big picture, broad stroke of human civilization and evolution to individuals in 2021, what do I get out of talking to strangers in this day and age?
Yeah, it's a funny thing because it is like it's been universal. It's been a very common thing for tens of thousands of years for humans to live among strangers. And yet it's only recently that psychologists started studying what happens. And that's twofold, you know, what keeps us from having these interactions, but what happens when we do have them? And on the latter point, what's been really interesting, and this has been a pretty universal finding across different cultures, different countries, you know, men, women, different people of different ages, is that when people have interactions with strangers, when they talk to strangers, and it can be fleeting, it can be more meaningful, longer, whatever the interaction, they report coming back feeling happier, feeling more connected to their communities, feeling an enhanced sense of belonging, which is really important at a time like ours, where people feel sort of estranged from the culture, from the people around them. They feel less lonely, which is really important. They feel more optimistic about humanity because, you know, there's a kind of quirk of human wiring that when we have one positive interaction, we tend to generalize that. So, you know, when you come out of a childhood like mine, where you're just like conditioned to fear strangers, and you have a positive interaction with one, you're like, okay, well, that's reassuring. Like, I don't have to worry about that person like throwing me in a van and taking me away. You know what I mean? And so the more you do it, the more that generalizes and the more positive you start to feel about the people around you. And from, you know, I've always been kind of skeptical. I'm not the type of person who would naturally conclude this, but I came away from this project feeling way better about people, even in a fairly, you know, tumultuous time.
We're talking to Joe Cohane about his new book, The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. You could join in if you like to talk to strangers or don't like it. Let us know. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Joe, before we get to our callers, you spend a lot of your time researching this book, going to people who have taught people how to talk to strangers, who have really embraced the idea of bridging this gap. You went to London, of all places, where stereotypically people don't talk to strangers, where there were classes. What did you learn about how to take that first step and talk to that stranger?
Yeah, if you felt like me, which was, I felt like I was out of shape, you know, the reasons why I had stopped talking to strangers for the most part had to do with just reliance on my phone, which I think is pretty universal at this point. And also that I was tired. I had a demanding job and I had a young kid and I was exhausted. So I wasn't hanging around. I didn't have the bandwidth. The really reassuring thing to me is that you can pretty easily build yourself back up socially. The project for me was I wanted to start from zero, almost like couch potato to marathoner, right? And I wanted to understand every step of the way as you go. So in the book, I lay out, like, you know, it's like a circuit training for becoming a social creature again after, like, you know, years in the hole of technology and COVID after that. And it starts very simple. It starts with, you know, resolving to make eye contact and say good morning to people. It has to do with when you ask someone how they are, actually mean it, actually be inquisitive about them, about their answer. And when they ask you how you are, you know, you can give them a real answer. You don't want to complain for a half an hour, but, like, you can be honest and they'll respond to that. And you know, I found it came naturally eventually. It was much easier than I thought. And the research backs this up, that while people are very pessimistic in some places, I think, you know, it depends on the culture in the region. People are very pessimistic about this, but when they actually do go out to seek out these interactions, they find it goes much better than they had anticipated. And for some people, it becomes a habit.
Well, we've got a lot of people who want to talk to us about talking to strangers. Let's hear from them. And let's start with Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Well, good afternoon. During the summer months, I'm a vendor at Civil War. I was a vendor at Civil War. I still am some. I'm a vendor at Civil War and special events. I run a shoeshine stand. And I never let the public go by me, pretty much. I engage them. I may just say hi. I wonder how the apple trees are getting along in the Antarctic this year. I get a smile out of them. Pretty soon you get a conversation going. But you don't let the public go by you. You engage them. And I see a few vendors that do that. They stand there and they don't engage the public. You just say a pleasant hi. Sometimes they'll just move on and that'll be it. And sometimes they won't. But you never know what you'll learn. Pretty much.
Eugene, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm lucky enough to have had the chance to chat with you in person a time or two over the years. Joe, Eugene says you never know what you're going to learn when you talk to a person. You share a lot of that in the book.
Yeah, that's the beautiful thing about it. You know, if you go into a conversation with an agenda and with, like, things that you want to talk about, you'll never get anything interesting or surprising. But if you go into a conversation being kind of open about the person and curious about the person, then in my experience, we talked to, you know, so many people for this book, they will unfailingly surprise you. You never know where it's going to go. And it becomes, like, you know, for me, it became a form of travel. It was like an adventure.
Eugene, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Let's go now to Michael in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. Funny story. I actually called in for the previous guest and just hung around because I had things to say about this one, too. So I make a habit of talking to strangers. And much like the guest was saying about growing up watching his parents talk to strangers in Boston, you know, when I was a kid, we would go on trips during the summer, a lot of times to national parks. And a lot of national parks have programs where they will bring in student workers from countries all over the world. And especially my dad would make a habit of talking to as many of these, you know, kids as he could. He always found it interesting. And now I'm, you know, in my early 30s, and I live in Appleton near downtown, and people will walk past my house all the time, and I'll talk to people from my porch, you know, just kind of talk to people if I run into them somewhere. And I always try to, you know, if someone seems interesting or they're wearing a shirt that I think is cool or just something, you know, I find something to sort of break that ice. And get into a conversation and you know, you can learn some really interesting things about people, like
awesome.
The guest was saying.
Michael, thanks a lot for telling us your story. And Joe, Michael brings up an interesting point, that opening statement, an opening thing to bring up to talk to someone who you don't know much about except for what you see.
Yeah, he raises a great point. You know, paradoxically, the key to talking to strangers – I found has nothing to do with talking. It has everything to do with noticing and then listening. Noticing maybe something that the other person is doing, or noticing something that you're both experiencing at the same time, remarking on it, and then just hanging back and letting them talk. And, you know, to my previous point, just letting them surprise you with their story.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Joe Cohane about his new book. It's called The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we'd be better off if we all talk to each other a little more? Do you talk to strangers, whether it's your postal delivery person or someone in the checkout line? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk now with Joe Cohane. His new book is called The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Steve joins us next in Winona. Steve, hi.
Hey, I'm across the river from you, but I can pick you up loud and clear.
Excellent.
I wanted to say that a little over 30 years ago, my life changed. And prior to that, I was the guy, don't stay away from me. Don't talk to me. Just leave me alone. Whether it was depression or whatever, it doesn't make a difference. That's no way to go through life. And I got connected with this group of people that helped me get rid of a vice. And they talked a lot and they talked to everybody. And I learned it's okay to talk to people. And it's interesting because today, I mean, I value my quiet times, and I like walking around a crowd of people and not talking to people too. But for the most part, when I came into Minnesota a couple of weeks ago, I stopped at a rest area, and here was a group of, there was just a big family, huge family, and they were trying to take pictures of themselves against the Mississippi River. And naturally, one person's taking pictures. Now they switch, and then the next person takes pictures of everybody, and then they switch. And I came over and I said, hey, would you like me to take a picture of all of you? And they were so excited. I took a couple pictures with their phone, and then they went back to talking. And then I looked up, and there was an eagle flying. And I said, look up, there's a bald eagle above us. And they were like, oh, they were just so amazed to see that.
Excellent.
But you know what, if you don't, and it really wasn't much conversation, but it helped them to have a better day. And I'll tell you what, somebody told me a long time ago, they said, when you shine the spotlight on somebody else, you can't help but splash some of that back on yourself.
Steve, I love it. Thanks so much for sharing your conversion experience there to talking to strangers. And yeah, it doesn't have to necessarily, Joe, be a huge, long-running interaction. Like, even the little things like that can be a big deal, right?
Yeah, you definitely get a little buzz out of it. It's funny, my wife is like the queen of taking pictures of people for them. And that definitely influenced me. And then I ended up, you know, to Steve's point, what he did was he helped them, but he also represented his state, his area for these people who are visiting. And they're going to come away and they're going to say, those people are great because of Steve, because of one guy, because we generalize our experiences in a lot of ways. And over the process of doing this book, I started doing a lot more of that, like being more deliberately helpful to tourists, being more deliberately helpful to people. And I did like the fact that I knew that they were going to come away from this feeling better about the city where I live. I live in New York. They would go home and they would say, people are so nice there. You know, it would be because like I took their picture. It doesn't take that much to make somebody's day better.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Steve, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Joe Cohane about his new book, The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. Let's go now to Rita calling from Franklin. Rita, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say my millennial offspring shake their heads, and one of them turns away. But, hey, I've done it all my life. It has always benefited me. And maybe
the others. Rita, thanks for the call. So Rita talks to strangers. Her kids are embarrassed by it. Joe, I don't know. Do you have advice for parents on how to bring their kids on board with politely talking to strangers?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just have to keep doing it and show them that it works. You know, but she raised an interesting point, which is there is a generational divide. For my parents' generation, it was much more normal to do this. And for younger people, specifically like 18 to 22, like much younger, they're so accustomed to doing all their communication on phones, on digital platforms, that their social skills have sort of eroded. So they might be embarrassed about their parent, but they also greet the prospect of just like chatting someone up, just interacting with someone in public with a sort of horror because they don't feel they know how to do it. So a really good lesson to impart to younger people is it's much easier than you think. You know, this is like an intrinsic capacity that we have. You just have to sharpen it a little bit. You have to work those muscles a little bit. And when you do it a few times, you know, most people will find that it's a pretty positive experience.
Thanks for the call, Rita. We'll go to Dave now in Appleton. Dave, hi.
Hi. Thank you. I love the title of your book. I engage people in conversations, and I take pictures of strangers with my phone. I will talk to them a little bit, and then I'll say, you know what I do just for fun is I take pictures of strangers. Would you allow me to take your picture?
Okay.
90% of the time, they'll say yes.
Awesome. And does that help strike up conversations, those people who are willing to have their picture taken?
Oh, it sure does, because it's often not the lead-in, but it's a culmination after a conversation. Can I also take your picture?
Interesting.
And then I'll ask some things like, what's your source of joy? And that leads into some interesting discussions as well.
Interesting, Dave. Thanks a lot. I'm glad, Joe, that he asked for permission to take pictures. I don't know that that would be a good icebreaker otherwise.
Yeah, there's an interesting point to be made here, too, which is, you know, because we tend to be wary of strangers, you do need to connect first, right? You have to kind of make people a little more comfortable, make them, you know, to kind of alleviate any suspicion they might have about what your intentions are. And so really just talking to them and coming across as like a good person to talk to, that might make them more open to something like a photo. Whereas if I just walked up to someone and I was like, can I take your picture? They would think that I was nuts. Like I haven't primed it properly. I haven't forged the relationship that would allow them to feel comfortable with me taking their picture.
Thanks for the call, Dave. Time for one more caller. Sue in South Range is with us now. Sue, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I wanted to tell you about an experience I had on a little island hop from Hawaii to Maui. My husband and I were sitting there talking about the car we were going to rent when we got on Maui, and we were going to drive around the island. And the fellow next to me said, oh, he said, by the way, if you do that, be sure to go counterclockwise around the island. That way you'll always be on the mountain side. You won't be on the side of the road that has the cliffs. The whole trip was so much more comfortable just because we talked to strangers.
I'm sorry, it sounds a little like you're on a plane right now, but she talked to someone and got valuable advice for her travels on it, Joe. It could pay off pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, you don't know what you don't know. So talking to people can introduce you to things that you never even considered before.
Well, Joe, 1 minute or so left. Leave us with a pep talk, maybe a bit of advice to find an opportunity to have a quick conversation with a stranger.
Yeah. So the best technique that I found came from a woman named Georgie Nightingale, who taught the class you mentioned in London, which I took for 4 days. And it involves what she calls breaking the script. So, it's called a preframe. I get confused. It's called a preframe. So when you're in a situation where you want to talk to someone, but it might not be the norm to do it, it might not be a social norm, you need to reassure them that you're not a threat and you're not crazy and you're not dangerous and you're not a creep. And the way to do that is to acknowledge that you know you're breaking the norm. So instead of me leaning over to someone on the subway here in New York and just like starting to talk to them, which they're going to be kind of suspicious of, I lean over and say, look, I know we're not supposed to talk to people on the subway, but I really like your glasses. You know, I'm in the market for a pair of glasses myself. Would you mind telling me where you got them from? And that little technique, just acknowledging that you're doing something that's outside of the norm, is tremendously reassuring to people. And it's a really good way to start a conversation. And it's also sort of audacious and it's sort of charming and it's sort of funny. And I did it a lot and it worked phenomenally well. It's a really easy and effective way to do it.
Fantastic advice, Joe. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It was a real pleasure.
Joe Cohane is a writer and editor. His new book is called The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. There's still time for you to share your story about talking to strangers. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if you like to do it, don't like to do it, if you have some advice on how to get the ball rolling. Again, that's the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, census numbers are out, so it's time for redistricting in Wisconsin, and the legal disputes have already started. We'll check out the road ahead for Wisconsin's election maps, and you can join the conversation. And a deadly disease, backlash against inoculation efforts, a partisan divide. Welcome to America in 1721. We'll get some lessons from the past. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Yesterday at this time, JC told you about a new calculation of the number pi, up to 68 trillion decimal points. It's a big milestone for math. I also celebrated a pi milestone yesterday. I was on a road trip, and after 30 years in Wisconsin, I finally got pie at the legendary Norske Nook in Osseo. I had a slice of chocolate peanut butter pie. It was really good. My wife went with raspberry Melba, also really good. But wait, there's more. Producer Bill Martins got in on the pie action. Hey, Bill.
Hey, hey.
What'd you make?
So I made a tomato pie last night, which I didn't even know existed until earlier in the week. My wife went out and picked a bunch of tomatoes, 7.5 pounds worth.
Wow.
I said, we gotta use these. So I'm looking for recipes, and I found this one for tomato pie. Looked really good.
So tomato pie, I think that's just pizza, right? No, it's something different?
Deep dish. Yeah, it's sort of like a quiche, but there's a bunch of layers of tomato in there and not quite as much egg. In fact, it only had one egg.
One egg for the whole thing. That's all that holds it together?
Well, there was also some mayo and some Dijon and some bacon, basil, chives, shallots.
What's the verdict, Bill?
Stuff. It was really good.
It was really good.
It was pretty good. I liked it.
Hey, guess
yeah,
what?
Pretty good.
We're going to talk about tomatoes in tomorrow's edition of Food Friday. Maybe we'll mention that pie. Thanks, Bill. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.